Welcome to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend.
So Tim, today we're lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Catherine Bolan of the Relations Space. And Catherine is a clinical psychologist with significant expertise in working with children, young people and parents in the context of post-separation parenting arrangements. So hi, Catherine. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for coming. I guess, Catherine, in episode one of our podcast, we spoke about what drew Gillian and I into family law. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, from my perspective, to do what we do, it can be incredibly arduous. There's a lot in there. The issues can be quite heavy from time to time. So as someone who's been working in this industry, in the family law space for quite a while, what's your buzz factor with it? What's your draw to doing this type of work?
You sound so young, Tim, your buzz factor. I love it. I agree with all the comments because at times it can feel grueling, exhausting. You know, there's a high degree of burnout in our professions, our joint professions, and I think there's a lot of vicarious trauma. There's personal danger. But on the flip side, like my view about it is, going really back to basics, I love psychology and I love thinking about relationships and why people do the things they do. And I mean, either that or I'm incredibly voyeuristic. I love stories. So I still feel fresh. I still feel when I get a new matter or a new case or a new group of or a child or children I have to assess, I still like the stories of what happens to people's lives because we're all sort of bumbling along trying to do the best we can, I guess. And I think that our job, I really enjoy like working with lawyers, working with judicial officers and others collaboratively to in some ways teach, but also share information, expertise about what happens, particularly for kids. So I think as long as I've always got that freshness and I always think, how can I use what I know about child development, psychology, parenting, conflict to help these parents and these kids get out of this mess the best way possible, then I feel I'm being productive in the world, I guess. So that's my buzz factor.
That's great. So you're a clinical psychologist, the buzz factor. Yes. So you're a clinical psychologist. What's the difference between a clinical psych and a normal psychologist?
Well, I'm so glad you asked because actually not many people know about it. A lot more training. A clinical psychologist is an expert in the treatment and assessment and diagnosis of mental health disorders. That's basically what the difference in our training is. So clinical psychologists at a minimum have done an honours and master's degree, including clinical supervision and training in particular settings such as hospitals or clinical practice. It's quite an arduous program and many have gone on to do PhDs and doctorates in the area. Psychologists in Australia are fortunately all registered with the health practitioner body, and so they are also trained in understanding human behaviour and relationships, but not with a specific focus on the diagnosis and treatment of disorder. So that's the difference. And I suppose where it matters in family law cases is that psychologists are often have very good expertise and training in family systems, family therapy, assisting children and parents in their communication, in their relationships. And where a clinical psychologist may be better placed is in probably the area of assessment and when there are particular sort of mental health concerns or concerns about personality, drug and alcohol issues, mental health functioning and that kind of thing.
Well, I guess you're really on the coalface because, you know, it's an interventionist type of role, the assessment of families and, you know, trying to navigate the, you know, importance of issues or the, you know, efficacy of issues. You're at the point where conflict has reached the boiling point. You know, you're seeing families at their absolute worst or the issues that are, you know, need to be investigated. It's a really, really big, important juncture in a family law matter.
Definitely. It's a big responsibility. And it's, you know, I don't know whether this is just because of my age or experience showing all the strange times we live in. But I think that the matters that I see are so complex. You know, I long for a simple matter where it's one single issue, but they're complex. They involve high levels of risk sometimes. And they're, as you said, I think, Tim, you sort of put it well, you know, people are absolutely at their worst when they meet someone like, well, they meet me or someone like me. And sometimes I have to remember that actually, yeah, I have to remember that. But also most people don't end up with in my office. Most people sort their issues out. But it's, you easily forget that when you're kind of right in the middle of assessing someone who is at a very high level of emotional intensity.
And in terms of that assessment process, so for us as family lawyers, I think one of the things that you talked about was enjoying in your work that engagement with people. And we've talked previously about the fact that, you know, it is the immediacy of the work that we do that does kind of, you know, make it really interesting and make it feel really fulfilling. And, you know, part of the work is about problem solving in that immediate way. But the assessments that we get are often really critical to allowing us to problem solve with clients, because sometimes it's that external feedback that allows us to explore issues outside of their own perspective. And give them, I guess, you know, some other options in terms of resolution or identifying what might be important for the other parent. So in terms of that assessment process, what does that look like from your end? Like, how does it work?
Yeah. So that's a big question. but I think that, I mean, it's a very rare thing for any of us in life to get straightforward, honest, unbiased feedback about something that we're doing, and particularly about something so personal as parenting or how we communicate. So actually, it's almost never the case, apart from maybe in your most intimate relationships or if you have teenage children, because they give you that feedback all the time, right? Scathing, critical feedback. Yeah. So I think that so I appreciate what you're saying. I think as a lawyer, and I think judicial officers think this as well, it's very rare but really useful to get neutral, unbiased feedback about how this particular parent is operating, how they're functioning, what things are they missing, what are their personality factors, what are their behavioural factors that are impacting on their children. So it's like I'm giving you a very long answer to a specific and short question. But the in my role...
No, we're enjoying it.
So. Okay, all right. Yeah. So my role in... If I've been appointed, for example, typically as a single expert, I'm asked to consider a whole range of things. They're usually factors that the court has asked me to look at, and sometimes they're very specific. So the children's relationship with each parent, any risk factors that might be present, the parent's mental health capacity. In a nutshell, what are the issues in this case? What things will help these children or this child? What are the parenting capacities of each of the parents and their degree of insight? And so there's multiple components to that. A large part of it is considering all of the documents and without criticizing your profession, but my gosh, the onslaught of documents these days. And I think now that, you know, my advice to my own children or people in my circle is, you know, everything that you write on Facebook, on social media, in a text could one day end up being in a subpoena. But that is sort of, you know, I've become very good at reading, not just text messages.
Can I say that's become a really It's become a really helpful litigation tool for us, Facebook and all those social media things.
Well, it's an interesting thing because obviously it actually really helps me too, because you see the bits of correspondence that are done in a perhaps a person's not best moment, but that's seeing someone as they really are. But my gosh, there's an onslaught of recordings of all sorts of stuff. So that does form a big part of my assessment, and then considering all the formal documentation and the subpoena document, then meeting each adult involved in the children's lives and conducting a separate, very comprehensive assessment of them, and then observing parents with children, and then interviewing children. So they're all the components that sort of make up a single expert assessment. So you can see that it's not, I think often people think, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to tell you everything in sort of but 1 or 2 days. But in fact, we have arrived definitely usually spent often weeks preparing for meeting someone and then considering all of those things, speaking to relevant professionals. So by the time I meet children, I've got a fairly specific idea about what things they have been through. So that's the sort of assessment process in a nutshell.
I guess from us, our perspective as family lawyers, this process and the assessment process is incredibly useful to us. And I think that a problem that we experience is where, you know, clients come to us with concerns or risk issues and so on. We're not qualified to make assessments either whether they're, you know, right or wrong, indifferent. We talk about risk and what's in the best interest of the children, and we talk about the legal side of it. And then, you know, this reporting function and the single expert report and family report is incredibly useful. Like what Jill said before about, you know, shaping perceptions and talking about what the, you know.
Well, I think it's an important tool. I wish, you know, and I think that you as lawyers dealing with people who are in a very emotionally burdened part of point in their lives, it's a huge responsibility. I mean, just a really good example and a common one, when parents are separated, let's say there's an anxious parent, and they may have appropriate anxiety. Anxiety is a normal response to things in life, but they may be particularly anxious about what's happening in the other parent's household. And what all of us tend to do when we're anxious is look for confirming evidence. So we find the examples in the other parent's behaviour where there's been things that have been suboptimal. And of course, the client is telling you as their lawyer all of these kind of terrible scenarios that have happened, maybe over the course of 10 years. There might be 4 or 5, but they're told with and felt and experienced with such emotional intensity. Yeah. And of course, you have to take those on board. But what you're not hearing and seeing, and this anxious parent may not be able to calibrate, is that mostly, you know, 95% of the time, the parenting has been appropriate, safe, and good parenting. But like any person, there have been, you know, like all parents have suboptimal moments. So it's really hard to delineate, well, is that just, you know, a once in a 2 year scenario?
I like that, suboptimal moments. I'm going to use that, Catherine. I hope you don't mind.
No. Well, we all have them, right? But the yelling at the child in the supermarket, or, you know, pulling the drink bottle of it, is that a suboptimal parenting moment, or is this an indicator of a more pervasive and dangerous parenting attribute? And sometimes when parents are really emotional, and especially when they're very anxious, they can't delineate those things, and it's a really tough call.
In terms of, I guess, that process and you kind of, you know, assessing those issues, how important is it in having the child participate in that assessment process and getting some feedback and I guess insight into their experiences in, I guess, you coming to your overall conclusions about how the family matrix and dynamic is working?
Well, I have really mixed views about it. So on the one hand, it's imperative. It's so important. You know, I see my job. I mean, first of all, I actually have a duty and obligation to reflect back to the court the child's views and wishes and the child's experience, and to promote the safety of the child or children's lives. And I take that obligation very seriously. And of course, for me, as a with an inquiring mind, that's the best source of information for me to know what truly happens in a house. But it's not without really big risk. And I'm so aware of the children that I see being often traumatized, not necessarily just by things that they've been exposed to, but by overt and implicit pressure to, they know when they meet someone like me that it's a high stakes situation. They see their parents acting in an abnormal manner with this stranger, sort of presenting in a certain way. They're often, or possibly even usually, given the Spanish Inquisition afterwards about what they have told me. I have unfortunately and regrettably seen way too many instances where parents will read their children elements of my report or show them court documents. This is far more common than we all wish it to be. Yeah. So children are under enormous pressure, and I think you have to balance this sort of, I absolutely agree that we want to listen to the voices of children, but at the same time, I also think children have a right not to participate, and we have to be really careful. I just see it as a huge responsibility not to just launch straight into you know, what do you want, and without understanding that even asking that question puts children at risk. And I just see so many children who are frightened, yeah, terrified, embroiled in the process. You know, really hyper, I've seen from children whispering, children sometimes, you know, opening my office door to make sure that no one's listening to what they're saying. And of course, I can't guarantee to that. I mean, I have to tell that child that nothing they tell me is confidential. We're in a, you know, and so that is a terrible position for a professional to be in, where you see this poor little kid who is so burdened by wanting usually to please both their parents and feeling really scared about doing the wrong thing. So I guess that's the way I sit on the fence about that issue about children's involvement. But it's the price or the cost of litigation, children exposed to conflict, and parents really underestimating. Children are smart. They intuit things. Not only do they hack into our iPhones and read almost everything that is available electronically in a house, but, you know, yourself, if you live with someone, you can sort of tell by the way they unload the dishwasher sometimes what mood they're in. And children who are exposed to conflict, they can wake up and just sense in the household what the vibe or tone of the house is. So they're smart. They know what's going on.
Just following on from that, and it's, I guess, a question I always sort of find a bit vexed, but, you know, obviously a lot of children going through a family law process are often engaged in their own therapeutic processes with, for example, their own psychologists, and, you know, records from psychologists can be subpoenaed as part of these proceedings. What's your kind of view or vibe about, you know, the impost on that therapeutic process with a litigation process where, you know, what kids may be saying in private for their own benefit.
It's a safe place for them.
Yeah, but it ultimately, you know, can be exposed to their parents and other parties through this process.
I mean, I don't know about you two, whether you've come across, I've got, again, a sort of it depends answer. That's the most frustrating thing about talking to you. Oh, it depends. In general, yes, absolutely. Therapy should be confidential. As you said, it should be a safe space for children. You know, people, regular people, including psychologists who aren't involved in this industry, don't think about lawyers and courts and the legal process, and nor should they, really. we shouldn't go to therapy.
Yeah, lucky them.
I know, right? Right. Can you imagine that kind of life? Not worrying about what's going to be subpoenaed? But that is actually how children should be, and how their interactions with their teachers should be, or their school counsellors, or their karate teacher, or whatever, whoever, poor professionals who don't want to be involved in any of this stuff, who don't want to go to court, and who really genuinely, by and large, just want to help this kid. So absolutely, I think that should be the case. Where I would have exceptions to that would be where there was really significant risk to a child. And of course, counsellors and psychologists are mandatory reporters, so that information usually appears in duplicate or triplicate or quadruplicate in other records. But the only other, and I don't know if you two have had experience of this, where occasionally, and I have to stress, very well-intentioned counsellors and psychologists go beyond the scope of what their job is with a child. So they might be providing therapy to a child.
It's happened so many times.
And they earnestly believe this child and the one parent who's brought them, say, to therapy, and want to help that child and that parent. And I really believe this comes from a good place. And in doing so, maybe they're under pressure. They write reports or they submit documents with very strong opinion about what should happen to this child. And, you know, regrettably, that information can fuel a whole round of conflict. And I do think it's, unfortunately, I've been in a position where I've had to give alternative views because I've got a much broader perspective.
You've got the whole picture.
Both sides of the story. I've read all the subpoenaed documents, and I can make a different sort of assessment. And I think, fortunately, those things are happening more and more often. And I do stress, I think it comes from a well-intentioned place, and I understand the reasons that it happens. But I think it can cause enormous problems. Similarly, if a child is given very specific counselling or an intervention, say assuming that they are the victim of family violence or sexual violence, when those facts actually haven't been established, there can be these unintended consequences of that intervention that are not necessarily helpful for the child. That makes sense.
I think it's both in terms of the children and parents as well, because I know that same experience what you're describing there I've had happen with adults who are accessing those services, and it makes them incredibly positional within the conduct of their family law matter, you know, and they are immovable on a position or a stance that they've taken. It can be on a single issue, it can be a much broader aspect to the matter, but it actually is disadvantageous to any pathway to resolution.
I completely agree. And I think that if you are getting, you know, when we are, I think when separation happens, it's normal and natural for your allies, your friends, your family members, and your professional network to come around you and support you and endorse you and your version of things. That's done, again, in a well-intentioned way. But I think the problem is very few people in that circle will challenge the individual and say, oh, have you thought about this? Or maybe it wasn't like that. And when you've got professionals, including psychologists, counsellors, support services, and it could be on a single issue, that are completely endorsing that point of view, it becomes religious. And it is very difficult to move
people. It does. Yeah. And I think as well, that process in terms of the expert report and going through that and unraveling all of those things, I think that we as practitioners in this space, in the family law space, know that the family court and the federal circuit court are so completely overrun, and the time it takes to get to court, go through a hearing process and all of that. We know in the family law space we have child inclusive memorandums to discuss all the different issues in relation to interim issues, interim parenting issues. And I know that at the relation space now, you're actually doing a private version of that, which I think is wonderful because it assists parties to get access and a quicker movement through that process. So could you tell us a little bit about that and what's involved in that process?
I think that the motivation for this is exactly as you've said. We've, like all of us, right, we've seen families in limbo for 2 to 3 years with the issues becoming more and more entrenched. And of course, the longer, for children, that's terrible. That's just sort of a shadow of their entire childhood. But also for parents, it gets them really stuck in their initial positions. And also the professionals are sort of hamstrung because you can't do anything with a client if no one has identified what the issues are. So
the court won't touch it either.
Well, they're just, it's a lack of resources, quite frankly. They're just, whilst that might have once been done in a timely manner, there just aren't the resources to do it. So as a private sector operator, we've had to say we need to do something to assist parents and lawyers resolve these issues earlier, because none of us like it when we see matters that have been litigating for 3+ years. There's never a good resolution to that, ever. For children, we can't make magic happen. So the idea was to give lawyers, parents, children, and the court options for a clinician to identify fairly quickly and on more limited information than might happen in, say, a full expert report. What are the key issues for these parents, these children? What services might be immediately appropriate, and or what further intervention might need to happen. And I think it's just a way of distilling very quick, in a timely manner, what direction this should go in. It might be that it needs a much more comprehensive assessment. It might mean that someone needs therapy, or it might mean that the issues are not as bad as as the lawyers all thought they were, and that there is some kind of compromise or solution that can be worked out in a much better way.
And, certainly in practice, I mean, getting even those kinds of short form reports that identify, the big issues that need to be worked through or the big problems that need to be solved, especially in matters where there might not be such extreme issues of risk or controversy around, difficult issues, they are just so helpful to be able to take to a mediation process or other settlement processes because, people, I think, sometimes then feel some confidence that they've got some external information and they can make decisions on a bit more of a level playing field.
Yeah, I think that it's the missing ingredient to those mediations and to for you assisting your clients have a settlement that is appropriate, that's child focused, and that helps them in the right direction for their own parenting and their kids, which is really why we do them, and they're very popular. And I think that trend will only continue because, in the situation we all find ourselves in now in the COVID times, I think that there's going to be even more of a backlog in the next few years.
Especially with the court merger. We're kind of, waiting to see how it's all going to unfold and how things are going to look. It's a very different litigation landscape we've got coming up.
Yeah. I mean, those all forms of assessment are resource intensive, and I think the direction is very clear that those sorts of things are going to have to be managed privately. So that's an important service for parents, I think.
Yeah. And on kind of a more coalface practical front, even before an assessment process, are there some things that, or practical tools that lawyers should be exploring with their clients to help minimise conflict or help improve their attitudes towards how they communicate with their former spouse in co-parenting that perhaps we can look into?
Well, I think it's a really big topic, and I think that always, I mean, if I had a wish list for family lawyers, it would be actually first and foremost yourself.
We want the wish list. Yeah, tell us everything. We want the wish list.
All right. Well, I speaking randomly, I would say first and foremost this. I would say look after yourself and your own mental health. You work in a really difficult, complex area of the law. It's very rewarding, but the challenge is that you are dealing with people who are very emotionally intense and who are at, as we've said sort of earlier, at their worst point in their lives. And that can mean that they are emotional with you, that they project their emotions onto you, and you can feel overly responsible for their children, actually, and for the terrible situation that we're in. And most of us have gone into this profession because we care about people. So that does sort of tug at the empathy strings. But the contagion effect of that I have seen in your profession is really high. So I have noticed, you know, good friends of mine who are family lawyers become really stressed out and then sometimes almost mirror the passive aggressiveness of their clients in just because they're so stressed out or they're, they're around that all the time. Am I speaking out of turn? Do you know what I mean?
Not at all.
Yeah. I think that probably the first tip is beware of the contagion effect and just do some things in your own life that are de-arousing. And at a very simple level, when it comes to communicating with your clients, be yourself, do some training in, or if you haven't done training in, just learn about how to slow your own heart rate down, how to slow your own tone of speech down, how to not mirror what your clients are giving you, because we operate in a really intense environment and the way our clients communicate with us, and sometimes we all communicate with one another, it's not normal. It's not healthy. So, you know, in answering your question, I realize I've gone way off track and said, well, this is what lawyers should do, not what the parents should do. But I actually think role modeling, calm communication comes first from us, and that very few things are
that's really interesting. Yeah.
Very
few things are an emergency. Some things are, but very few, many less things are an emergency than our clients might be presenting in an emergency like state, because they're in flight or fight, they're in full arousal. So my first thing is things can wait. We don't always need to immediately respond to things. And our first job always is to calm ourselves down before we write correspondence, before we speak to someone on the phone, before we write the Facebook post. But that's
especially before we send correspondence.
And that's the skill actually we're asking our clients to have, is just calm down. Don't press send. Just think before you speak. That would solve like 80% of the problems.
My motto is you write angry and send happy.
Leave something 24 hours, you know, that don't, you know, have, because I think that that automatic response when we're angry, when we're emotional, rarely leads to a good outcome. So there's lots of things that you can help lead your clients towards, but ultimately what you're trying to help them with is emotional regulation. If we're not emotionally regulated ourselves, it's the same thing I would tell parents, you know, what are you trying to do? You're racing around sort of frantic, you know, giving the middle finger, road rage, and yet you're driving your child to, you know, a therapy appointment. It's like that it doesn't matter what happens in that therapy appointment. Children are learning from the role models around them. So similarly, our clients, and I'm talking about both all of us in working with people who are needing our support, they actually need us to be like a calm, contained parent. So we better do that for ourselves. But other than that, there's lots of ways that we can help parents learn communication skills, learn self-regulation skills, whether that's going to therapy to get those, whether it's going to in-person parenting class. We do have an online course that helps parents regulate their emotions and learn some of their own personal triggers. I think all of those interventions have their place.
I think that's absolutely true. One common piece of feedback I receive from clients is, I don't need to do that. I'm a good enough parent already. Or there's a, you know, an elitism in terms of their parenting capacity and so on. And my feedback always is, it's not an indictment on your parenting. The court will never look at you trying to improve or gain further experience and knowledge about how you can be the best parent you can be in a negative way. It's actually a really useful tool for your own personal growth and development for the benefit of your children. It's a fantastic thing that separated parents can use and employ to stop. I mean, you know, a lot of the discussion today has been about what happens when we get to the, you know, the crescendo in conflict. You know, that can, those sorts of things can often alleviate a lot of that pressure and bring it back to a, you know, some sort of post-separation normalcy, you know?
Can I say, Tim, one of the other things I sometimes say to clients, and maybe Catherine, you'll think this is terrible, but when they're going through an assessment process, you know, putting aside the parenting courses, I often say they should look at it as an opportunity, because it's not often, I mean, if you're just running along parenting in a non-separated context, you don't ever get the feedback that you can get from an assessment process. And I'm like, it would be fascinating and probably super useful to have someone say, here are the ways that you can optimize how you're parenting your particular children. So, I mean, I don't know if that's the right thing to say, but that's sometimes how I try and sell it to the client.
I think it's a great thing to say. I think I wish more lawyers would sell it to the client in that way. With an acknowledgement that it's hard to hear. You know, if you have a dietitian or a personal trainer or a health professional like that who, you know, gives you the hard talk to, that's more useful than someone who says, you're amazing, you're great, yay you. Yes, I like the way you talk about it. But I also acknowledge, and I think I hope that any professional in my position does this as well, acknowledges that it's an unusual, it is also very hard to hear things when you're most parents, they want to do a really good job with parenting, and they don't, and when we make mistakes, we don't intend harm, but sometimes our behaviors can cause harm or be less than optimal for our child's particular needs at that point in time. So I think it's good the way you sell it.
So in terms of what that looks like for separated parents, what would be your three best tips for parents to do something or change a behaviour that would minimise conflict between them in a post-separation context? So, you know, one thing that I often give advice is, you know, there are a lot of great apps now that you can use where you've got a joint calendar and it's a single source of communication. So there's not emails and texts and phone calls and so on. And, you know, it's a place where you, when you're in that headspace and you need to have a look, you go have a look and then you can put it out of your mind. What are some of the things that you think of like that, that assist?
Yep, I think that those apps are absolutely fantastic. And as you said, there's sort of more and more of them on the market. I think that it at an even more basic level, so it goes back to sort of one of the comments you made about not, you know, send something, write it angry, send it happy. Very little communication is absolutely urgent when it comes to children. So let things rest before you send them. I always advise parents, if I'm in an advisory capacity, just be a negative sort of appraisal of your profession, when they are getting information from their own lawyer, to put that in a separate, have it diverted immediately to a separate inbox so they don't read it when they're at their child's swimming lesson or they're on their way to a work meeting or a date or whatever they're doing, because those bits of correspondence.
That's great advice.
Yeah, those bits of correspondence, even if they're from your lawyer, will usually contain, oh, we received this from the other side and how do you want me to respond? And there is, unless it's urgent, it's to be dealt with at a time. And I would just say block out the time, a bit like you might do, I don't know, your accounting or some job like that, you know, once a week or whatever is appropriate for the amount of correspondence you're dealing with. where you've got no distractions and you can be sort of emotionally available for that and deal with it then, and to really deal with it in a factual, non-emotional manner, have someone there with you if you need to, rather than it catching you by surprise at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, when apparently all lawyers write all their correspondence, I'm told. So I think that's a really important.
We don't, though, Catherine, we don't.
Okay. Very good. I would say the other thing is to, back to that, the comment about your own self-regulation and to be hyper aware of your own self-regulation. And the other thing, and with that comes, do whatever it takes to calm yourself down, to give yourself time off, and to give yourself respite from the conflict with the other parent. And this is just really left of field, I suppose. Enjoy your children, because they're only with you for a very short period of time in your life. And I think that often the parents I see are so stressed and so involved in the conflict that's happening with the other parent and the legal process that they're actually not enjoying their children as they are at this moment in time. You know, your child will only ever be a toddler once, or a school-aged child once, and those years go very, very quickly. And I think parents forget to be in the moment with their child, no matter what else is going on. That time is precious and limited, and notice it and enjoy it.
That's such an interesting observation, because parents come to us, you know, if it's a situation where, you know, the other parent has the lives with order and the children are with that parent for the majority of the time, and your client has significant and substantial time, like each alternate weekend, and there's, you know, robust views about their that appropriateness in their mind, you know, the method, the thought process to be, make the time golden, make it the best time ever, and enjoy your children.
Yeah, and I mean, your kids are unlikely as adults to, you know, focus back on, oh, my childhood was terrible because I had a 6-8 arrangement instead of, you know, a 5-9 arrangement or whatever. You're absolutely right. Like, it's about, you know, the quality of that time. But, you know, these are still really challenging things for clients to work through anyway, because, I mean, you know, they're the most important issues to them generally. So,
yeah, 100%. And, you know, parenting is a long game. You know, we don't stop parenting when children are 18. And I say this as a parent of one adult, semi-adult, and two becoming adults. You have lifelong relationships with your children that will extend well beyond this litigation, their childhoods, and as you said, they don't remember the time division, but they might remember how distracted or stressed you were, and they remember the weirdest things.
That's incredible, Dr. Boland. We really have appreciated your time today. We've taken up a lot of your time, and we are so incredibly grateful for you agreeing to come and speak with us today.
Well, that's my pleasure. It's been lovely to speak with both of you.
Yeah, and
you'll look after yourselves, yeah?
We'll take the advice.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been amazing. You know, and I'll make sure that I check Tim's emails on Friday afternoon to check that he's not really sending emails. All right. Thanks. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend. To find out more about your hosts and what they do, visit chamberlains.com.au. And now, here's the bit the boss insisted we say. The information in this podcast is for general educational purposes only. None of the content should be considered legal advice. Please don't make decisions based on the information in this podcast without seeking professional legal advice of your own. For more information, visit chamberlains.com.au.